Hello there. Today is Thursday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president says a Republican health care bill is making great progress.
We have to have health care, and it can't be Obamacare, which is melting down.
The White House prepares to welcome the new leader of South Korea. A new survey finds America standing in the world has declined. Also ahead, how social media might help us see the future. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump hosts South Korean President Moon Jae-in for cocktails and dinner later this evening, a prelude to talks on Friday, which a senior White House official says will focus on the threat posed by North Korea. It'll be the first time the two leaders will meet. VOA's Victor Beatty says asks Senior Director of the Korea Society, Stephen Norper, what President Moon hopes to accomplish on this visit.
Well, he's seeking to try to reinforce the relationship with the United States. He has a lot of challenges by way of the North Korea equation and also getting China back online, but he wants to signal to the United States that the alliance is strong and that he still is roundly committed.
There's a concern about trade relationship with the free trade pact between the two that Mr. Trump says he'd like to scrap and start over.
Well, there is, in the sense that there is going to be a revisiting to it. It's probably a situation that need not be contentious. There'll be some objections raised about some particulars, but remember, the South Korean president's arrival was also marked by the announcement by Samsung that they were investing a significant sum, over $300 million, into a plant in South Carolina. And that's just emblematic of the increase in South Korean investment in the wake of the Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which was implemented a half decade ago.
Are the two leaders on the same page with regard to North Korea?
Well, they seemingly have different dispositions in terms of the timing and the aspect of engagement. Yet they both underscored the idea that you need a strong line with North Korea, especially in light of the nuclear and missile concerns. And so Moon Jae-in has been saying he's very much in line with where Trump is. The actuality may be that they're not exactly in accord, but they'll certainly try to discuss the differences.
Is it possible that South Korea could have some sort of direct contact with North Korea?
It is possible, and one of the concerns that came out of an interview that was done by CBS News in Seoul was that the question was basically put to Moon Jae-in of whether he would consult with Trump on that issue, and he was taken aback, because I think the Koreans feel that this is an inter-Korean process. Certainly Moon Jae-in has thought about this for a great deal of time in his experience as chief of staff for former President Noh Moo-hyun. In the decades since then, when he has been out in terms of opposition leadership. And so he feels that he has a way forward with North Korea, that it's a Korean division that will require a Korean solution. But that in no way negates the alliance with the United States, and he feels that's fundamentally important as well.
Is the delay of the deployment of the THAAD U.S. Anti-missile shield in South Korea going to be a problem?
Well, many people are reporting that it shows a stark difference. Moon has emphasized that he simply wants the environmental impact statement to be put into play, and that will cause a delay in deployment, but that he doesn't intend to curtail it. However, we'll see how that plays out, and there may be different approaches taken over time on the THAAD issue. It clearly is an irritant with China, and so Moon Jae-in is trying to strike that balance with China as well.
North Korea's U.N. ambassador made a rare appearance to the Security Council and warned the U.S. and the rest of the world that his country will keep building up its nuclear arsenal regardless of sanctions.
Yes, the North Koreans are certainly in a very hard line, but that's to be expected around the summit meeting between the South Korean and U.S. presidents. So expect to hear a great deal of harsh rhetoric in the coming few days as they try to negate that meeting or try to create wedges between South Korea and the United States. So that comes as no surprise, and it certainly is consistent with the type of thing that's been heard from North Korea, and it again reinforces international concern and certainly the concern between Seoul and Washington over the threat that North Korea poses.
All right, that's Korea Society Senior Director Stephen Norper. Republicans huddled in their U.S. Capitol offices on Wednesday to discuss changes to their Senate health care bill proposal as they look to craft new provisions ahead of next week's Independence Day recess and then vote on it when they come back to Washington the following week. This as Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer challenged the president and Republicans to reach a compromise.
I'd make my friends on the Republican side and President Trump an offer. Let's turn over a new leaf. Let's start over. Let's abandon more tax breaks for the rich. Let's abandon cuts to Medicaid and discuss what the American people are really concerned about: premiums, deductibles, the cost and quality of health care. President Obama invited both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to Blair House to discuss health care reform in front of the American people early in his first term as president. President Trump, I challenge you to invite us, all 100 of us, Republican and Democrat, to Blair House to discuss a new bipartisan way forward on health care in front of all the American people.
President Trump voiced optimism that Republican senators would be able to reach agreement to overhaul national health care policies, but he conceded it could be very tough. And asked by reporters about Schumer's proposal, this was Trump's response.
Mr. President, Senator Schumer says he'd like to come down and have all 100 senators come here to talk health care. Would you be willing to negotiate with all of them?
Thank you. Got to find out if he's serious. He hasn't been serious. Obamacare is such a disaster, such a wreck, and he wants to try and save something that's really hurting a lot of people. It's hurting a lot of people. He'd have to be very, very serious. You know, he's done a lot of talking, bad talking, and he just doesn't seem like a serious person.
As an independent analysis of the Republican plan by the Congressional Budget Office concluded this week that 22 million people would lose their health insurance over the next decade compared to Obamacare. But Trump said the Republican plan will be great for everybody. National surveys show Obamacare winning new popularity, even as Republicans try to keep their campaign pledge to get rid of it. Meanwhile, several polls show that Americans do not like the Republican proposal. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. boosts security measures for all foreign airlines flying to the U.S. U.S. lawmakers are readying a North Korea travel ban. Officials are finalizing details of Trump's revived travel ban himself. And music, mushrooms, and more at the Maryland Folk Festival. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app, this is International Edition. Five months into Donald Trump's presidency, the image of the United States has deteriorated sharply across the globe. According to a new survey from the Pew Research Center, an overwhelming majority of people in other countries have no confidence in his ability to lead. The fall was the steepest among some of America's closest allies, such as Mexico, Canada, Germany, and Spain. Joining me now to talk more about this, attorney and national security expert Jack Rice. Jack, what exactly specifically did the survey find?
It breaks it down by country, but it also breaks it down by age. And so you will look at what the United States looks like through the eyes of young people, older people, Brazil, Mexico, Germany, South Africa. It's really astounding when you see this country through the eyes of the world. And I think when the U.S. has to work through that, it really can change how the U.S. has to address it.
So what exactly did it find regarding the current president, President Trump?
Well, what was interesting is how the U.S. has seen this president and the United States, and in some ways they're different. We found that at the end of President Obama's presidency, he had a 64% approval rating overall from across the world, whereas President Trump has a 49% approval rating. So that's quite a dip. What's interesting is it's somewhat consistent with what you saw with President Bush at the very end of his presidency. Well, actually, his was much more positive through some of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end, when it was the most negative, that's where Donald Trump is right now.
Does it talk about what the negative views are? What in particular? Anything specific?
It does, actually. When you look at the reason, one of those had to do with Donald Trump talking about pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, talking about immigration, talking about the Paris Climate Change Accord, and about the Mexico Wall. Consistently across the world, we find that that's what drove his numbers down. Although, interestingly enough, there were two countries in the world where President Trump actually increased in popularity, and that was Russia and the Israelis.
Hmm.
So for different reasons, and I think it has to do with some of their internal politics, and I think how this president has approached each of those countries, they see him more positively than actually they saw President Obama at the end of his presidency.
You mentioned Russia. There's obviously a lot of talk about Russia, its influence in our 2016 presidential campaign, and we are hearing that President Trump is, according to sources, eager to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin when the two are in Germany for that multinational summit next month. His advisors seem to be pushing back on that. Would that be a political mistake on his part to get too chummy with Vladimir Putin at this point in time?
It's very clear that the Republican Party has been very, very concerned about this issue themselves in terms of how it's being seen politically. And in fact, we saw a move from the Republicans and the Senate in general to make sure that the president couldn't drop sanctions against the Russians. This was clearly an effort to try to distance the Americans from Vladimir Putin and to try to push back on the presidency themselves. So it'll be interesting to see what it is that President Trump does when he has the opportunity to sit down with President Putin in Germany in the coming months. And circling back, 75% of those who responded to the Pew Research Center poll said that they thought that this president was arrogant. Some 65% thought that he was potentially dangerous. Of those, some 55% of those people then turned around and said that President Trump was a strong leader. So it's interesting what that seems to mean to various people. I don't know what that means. But to one last point, what this poll also did was distinguish between how these people saw the United States as a whole and how they saw the American people. And they saw them differently. Generally speaking, the poll found that people around the world like Americans. Those numbers are 58% and higher, depending upon where we are. And this has to do with culture, the ideas of the people themselves, and just general popularity. So it's interesting, regardless of who the political leader is in office, people seem to like Americans more than they like America.
All right. Attorney and national security expert Jack Rice, thanks for being with us. Former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is a Republican and a strong critic of President Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, was in France over the past weekend, where he met with French President Emmanuel Macron. The two attended a forum where they were joined by former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and others, and then Macron also unveiled a new campaign to protect the environment. Joining me now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, tell us more about this.
French President Emmanuel Macron really seems to be wanting to take visible leadership, particularly when it comes to the Paris Agreement. France is really particularly proud of the Paris Agreement, not just because it was, you know, all came together here in Paris, but also it's something that it feels it can really take a lead on. And what Emmanuel Macron has come up with now is he's got together with literally dozens of lawyers and scientists, and they've come up with an idea for a global pact to protect the human right to a clean and healthy environment. And that all stems from going from these other famous covenants that we have through the United Nations, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, that this one would really enhance the idea of living in a clean, healthy environment as part of the necessity for, if you respect the dignity of the human person. So Emmanuel Macron has said he's going to take this text, which has got 26 articles in it, take it to the United Nations in September, and start what he says is clearly going to be a long, long road to get that agreed, and that will end up being a world pact for the environment.
Is this an extension of the Paris Climate Agreement, or is this in addition to?
This will be an extension of it, and this will take it even further, and will, if they get it through it, make it necessary as a basic human right that governments have to look after climate, have to respect climate change, and have to make sure that people can live in a tolerant environmental climate. That means worrying about pollution, worrying about climate change, worrying about, for example, whether your countries particularly that are burning too many forests. All that will come under an umbrella of human dignity, that human beings should not have to be subjected to this kind of environmental degradation. They shouldn't have to live in places where this is going on.
And how is this idea being received throughout Europe with other nations there?
They're really very keen on it. There has been a lot of bewilderment about how President Trump has reacted, not just to climate change, but also to the Paris Agreement. And in particular, at the moment, we've got the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel. She's getting ready to have talks with the Indian Prime Minister and with the Chinese Premier to try and make sure that they stick with the Paris Agreement. Because don't forget, if India and China pull out, then the whole process could unravel. So in that particular way, the German Chancellor is making sure they're on song, especially ahead of this big G20 summit that's coming up in Hamburg the 7th and 8th of July. That's the world's biggest economy. 20 of their leaders will be in Hamburg. And again, you're going to get back to countries such as India, China. Are they still on board with the Paris Agreement? And will they stand up to the American president and say, we're going to stick with it. Please, can you do some sort of change of mind? A lot of countries are putting yet more money into it. For example, here in France, the French president has just pledged about $33 million to give to universities and other organizations so as they can fund the work of up to 50 climate researchers over the next 5 years. So you're not only getting Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, talking to her colleagues, you're also getting money being put into research over the near term. These aren't initiatives that we're talking about in 10, 15 years' time. These are initiatives which they're talking about happening right now.
All right. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on this. Paris-based reporter, Catherine Field. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now, turning to what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Lori, how would you like to see into the future?
I would.
Who wouldn't,
so.
Right? Who wouldn't
no,
want to
I
see
would,
into the
definitely.
Future? Everybody wants to know what's going to happen
of
so
course.
They can pick the lucky lottery numbers and all that kind of stuff. Well, social media, according to two academic studies, can give us a glimpse into the future.
Really? How so?
Well, the first study from the University of Washington and the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory looked at different instances where people talk about things that are going to happen. So they looked at things like elections, economic trends, even the spread of disease and public health. And they found that when people talked about some of these issues, they could actually predict what was going to happen based on what they talked about. So some of those are pretty obvious. Elections, of course, if you're talking about one candidate more than another, it's more likely that candidate's going to win. But things like economic trends, it's interesting. They said that people who talk about, oh, you know, I've got to cut back on my budget or do this or do that, you can actually predict, based on what they're saying, some things that could happen. So it could potentially give us a glimpse into the future. Now, the caveats to this are that they have to cut through the social media noise, as we call it, all of the different posts and things that are going on, to get through to the actual data that would help them answer this. But this study gives some indication that if they can define an algorithm or work on some way to cut through that noise and look at these very specific posts, could give us a glimpse into the future.
Wow.
Yes.
I like it.
I do, too.
The social media crystal ball.
Yes. And if that wasn't enough, mm-hmm. another study from the University of Cardiff in the mm-hmm. UK has found that social media can actually predict riots and address them faster than police. So what they did was they looked at tweets from the London riots back in 2011, and they looked at the timing, the content, the frequency, and tone of these tweets. They looked at more than 1.6 million of them. And they found that the computer algorithms that they designed from these tweets to look at these different elements could actually help them detect when the riots were going to happen faster than the police were able to respond. So even before the police were able to get there or put it out on their social media, these algorithms found that these riots were going to happen.
This all could really have some big implications for the good.
Definitely. And not just on the big scale, like things like riots and terrorist attacks, but even small scale things, traffic accidents, house fires, robberies, things that if people are tweeting about them and they're in an area, social media can hone in on that and figure out what's going on and maybe help to address that. So we'll see if this study, of course, using tweets that are 6 years old, can be extrapolated to the real world. But it's a very promising sign that it may very well be, and we might get another glimpse into the future. And, as you said, social media doing some good there.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Gru, Lucy, and the lovable Minions are back in the third installment of the movie Despicable Me, which opens in the United States this week. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film offers new characters, but many of the same laughs as its predecessors.
Former arch-villain turned good guy Gru, voiced by Steve Carell, is back, along with the Minions. But living inside the law is proving tough for Gru. He has to face an old nemesis, Baltazar Bratt, voiced by Trey Parker. Bratt has a plan to steal the world's largest diamond and take revenge on Hollywood, which canceled his 1980s preteen show when he reached puberty.
It's some kind of monster.
Wait, that's not a monster. That's a man wearing shoulder pads. There's only one supervillain whose fashion sense is quite that dated. Free! Balthazar Bratt.
When Gru and his partner and wife Lucy, voiced by Kristen Wiig, bungle a chance to catch Bratt, they're fired from the Anti-Villain League. The Minions try to convince Gru to go back to a life of villainy, but he resists. Then the yellow pill-shaped goggle wearers in overalls strike out on their own. When Gru is struggling with an identity crisis, he gets a message from a long-lost twin brother, Dru. The blonde-headed, white-suit-wearing Dru, also voiced by Carell, tells his brother that their family has a long history as bad guys, and he tries to get Gru to teach him the finer points of villainy. At the film's Los Angeles premiere, writers Cinco Paul and Ken Dario said they developed the storyline as a way of expanding the despicable family.
We sort of were wondering, like, how do you expand this family? What's the next step? And once we kind of came onto this brother idea,
it was either a dog or a brother. And we thought,
brother might be more fun. Yeah, you can talk to the brother.
Right, yeah.
Trey Parker says this movie gives him a chance to let his young daughter see his work, something she can't do when he's on the more maturely themed South Park.
And at the time, my daughter was about a year and a half old, and I was like, she could actually watch this. Like, this is something I could do that I could, she wouldn't have to, you know, I wouldn't have to keep her away from. So it was kind of great, and it kind of like all comes down to, this was the moment I was, this was the day I was always thinking about, was being able to take my daughter to a premiere and say, yeah, see, I did that, because I can't do that with South Park, because I'm like, Daddy does this, you can't watch it, but this is what Daddy does, you know.
Steve Carell said that Despicable Me 3 offers families a welcome respite from the more serious news of the day.
It's just positive and fun and silly, and you don't have to think too much about it. It's just a good time, and I think this day and age is kind of nice.
Kristen Wiig echoed Carell's sentiment, saying Despicable Me offers a chance to laugh and enjoy a couple of hours together.
You know what? I feel like it's just a really light, fun movie, and it's silly. And just to like go in the theater and laugh for 2 hours with how crazy the world is right now is a good thing. And parents will enjoy it, kids will enjoy it, so it's a good bonding movie.
The animated Despicable franchise has made nearly $3 billion since the first Despicable Me, including the spin-off movie Minions. Despicable Me 3 is rated PG for action and rude humor. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Also, learn more about the battle for Mosul from VOA's reporters on the ground in a multimedia special report at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
United Nations peacekeepers play a critical role in providing stability in regions recovering from conflict. They can prevent outbreaks of violence and stabilize weak or failed governments, which can serve as havens for terrorists or transnational criminal organizations that foster conditions for mass atrocities. Peacekeeping missions are a critical tool for promoting peace and reconciliation in some of the world's most troubled countries, wrote Major General Michael Rothstein, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Plans, Programs, and Operations in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs. Today, more than 113,000 UN personnel from 124 countries serve in peacekeeping roles in 16 missions around the world, in Africa, the Middle East, the Caribbean, and Europe. The diverse, robust, and demanding mandates of each of these missions see peacekeepers working to contain violent groups, protect civilians, bolster stability, and promote health and well-being. One of the important ways the United States government supports UN peacekeeping is through the Global Peace Operations Initiative, a security assistance program coordinated by State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs. The initiative strengthens international peacekeeping capacity by helping to train and equip peacekeepers to carry out the work that is required of them. To maximize effectiveness, program managers need to understand peacekeeping requirements and shortfalls. That is why representatives from key U.S. government organizations and the United Nations met for 5 days in mid-June at the 11th Global Peace Operations Initiative Worldwide Consultations, sponsored by the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs and the Defense Department's Office of the Secretary of Defense. Participants discussed the evolving nature of peacekeeping, ways to strengthen performance and operational readiness of peacekeeping units, and efforts to address sexual exploitation and abuse by peacekeepers. United Nations peacekeepers play an indispensable role in advancing the cause of peace and security in a world ever more burdened by violence and instability, wrote Deputy Assistant Secretary Rothstein. This is a difficult task, and the United States is committed to working with like-minded countries to continue to push for both greater effectiveness and fiscal efficiency in this important mission. As a leading source of financial, technical, and material support for building peacekeeping capacity, the United States demonstrates its ongoing commitment to effective UN peace operations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.